History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative to ask a few questions and then exercise the patience to listen as memories that may have been buried for decades emerge once again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is 99-year-old Jack Kappeler of Bakersfield, California. That part of the Golden State has a long history in the oil business, and Jack spent his career as part of that industry. But first, he had to survive his time as a Navy fighter pilot during World War II. We're going to hear about those adventures and also a little bit about Jack's older brother, Frank, a navigator on one of those B-25s that famously flew off of the USS Hornet to strike Tokyo as part of the Doolittle Raid in 1942. Let's talk first, Jack, about your childhood. Tell me where you grew up and what you remember about those early years.
Born and raised in Alameda, California, a family of two boys. My brother was 9 years older than me, and he was my model. I did everything he told me to do, and he was a great leader.
And that's a Navy town, huh?
Yeah, it's right on the bay, and yeah. When they first got the Navy into Alameda, they got carriers coming in, so I got to watch carriers coming in and out. They didn't do any landings on the carriers, but they did use the base for carrier qualification.
And anybody that goes to the Bay Area now, one of the things they notice and they look for are those big bridges. I don't think those were there when you were growing up.
I was going to grammar school and high school. Both bridges were being built, the Golden Gate and the Bay Bridge, yeah. So every morning you'd get to see a little more improvement on the bridges. Took them 20 years to build both of them, yeah.
And, you know, you're growing up during the era we know now as the Great Depression. Was that something that your family felt? Did you see evidence that things weren't the way they're supposed to be?
Oh, yeah. I had kids that their dads lost their jobs. They didn't have enough to have food in the house. I knew my mother helped out families in my neighborhood that were without dads, without jobs. My dad brought neon into the United States and had a company of neon products. That was the height of his career. He made more money then, I guess, than afterwards. So we were a pretty lucky family, yeah.
So the neon signs up and down the East Bay, those were all built by your dad?
Yeah, most of them were all right in Oakland, yeah. Uh-huh. We went to the Hawaiian Islands for, I guess, when the company became incorporated. And out of Waikiki at night, they had an introduction of the company to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And I was, what, 7, 8 years old, and I never forgot that. Quite impressive.
I could see how that would stick in your head. And I want to get the whole scope of this. So the very first neon signs in America were brought here by your father?
That was my understanding, yeah. They had a sign company, uh-huh, with the light bulbs that you screwed in.
Yeah.
And it was the Electrical Products Corporation, uh-huh, of Oakland. They got the original contracts or patents for neon, yeah. First signs they put up, going into Hawaii on one of the islands out there. It wasn't a man-made island, I guess. They had a neon sign, "Welcome to Hawaii." That was one of the first signs that they used to publicize the company.
Did you ever talk to him or hear his account of how that came to be, where he got the idea or what told him this was going to work?
It's just kind of evolved. As far as he was a sheet metal worker, and his salesman was a graduate, I guess he had a PhD and smart enough to know what to do. And he got the guys going and formed the company, yeah.
And you mentioned the Welcome to Hawaii sign. Were there any other signs that were memorable to you that you used to drive by or see and say, hey, that's because of my dad?
The one down here, the roof of the hotel the big sign there they put up is still there. Padre, yeah.
In Bakersfield?
Yeah, I guess it's still there.
How about that? Yeah.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned that you did everything your brother did, but do you remember as a young boy having some ideas in your head, hey, someday this is what I'm going to do, these are my hopes, my dreams, my ambitions?
Yeah, yeah. Well, my brother got put into the Air Force, and I don't know why, just to be contrary, I guess. I studied more about the Navy aviation, and I became a real addict of naval aviation. Living in Alameda, I saw all the carriers come in there and saw all the carrier planes. That became more my desire than flying in the Air Force.
And a lot of times when I talk to guys who flew, there's often a moment early on where something got their attention that gave them that flying bug or made them think, hey, maybe I can do that someday.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. I got a ride from somebody at Oakland Airport in a plane, and that ticked me off. Geez, maybe I can do this.
And your brother went in the Army Air Corps before World War II, I'm guessing, huh? Do you remember what you thought about that or what your view was?
Everybody was doing it. You know, I say everybody.
Sure.
And most of the guys that were out of school and had the education could qualify going into the service. They made more money in the service than they did in civilian life. Yeah.
Let's talk about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember that day and how you found out what happened?
As I recall, it was early in the morning. I think I was at home, yeah. Well, I was in the service waiting to be called into the Navy at that time.
You turned 19 2 days before this happened. When you heard that news, was that eye-opening? Was that a jolt? How would you describe the impact of that news, what had happened out there?
I was a young kid, I gung-ho to go in and fly, and my brother had been Air Force, and I had to be contrary. I always had looked up to the Navy, so that was going to be my desire, to fly in the Navy. Yeah. And the communications in those days wasn't very good. You'd have a run radio that maybe you'd get it. No TV. You didn't see anything on TV.
How did you feel about your brother being in the war, since he was in before you?
Yeah, real proud of him. He was my model, to try to follow and do everything he had done. But I was anti-Air Force. I was always in favor of the Navy. And we continued that the day he died.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you concerned at all that he might not come home from this war?
Never thought about it, no. Kids don't get involved in that. I never thought that way. We lived in Alameda, so the Hornet was docked in the docks at Alameda Naval Air Station. So, yeah, he left from there, and we put him on board and watched him go, not knowing where they were going.
But because of your awareness and your familiarity with naval aviation, you noticed that there was something aboard that carrier that wouldn't usually be there?
Oh, yeah, I thought unusual that they put V-25s on a carrier. That's really never been done before. And, of course, they use the excuse they were just transporting them.
So you and your family go to see your brother off. It's the USS Hornet, CV-8. In Alameda, and you being an aviation guy yourself, you notice, hey, there's B-25 bombers on an aircraft carrier. They've never flown off an aircraft carrier. What's going on?
Right.
And I know your brother and the rest of those men who were about to become the Doolittle Raiders, they weren't allowed to talk about any of this, but did he say anything at all to you before you said goodbye that maybe gave you just a little hint of the history he was about to be a part of?
Oh, nothing. Just keep watching the news. Keep watching the news. It's gonna, something big will come up, and when that happens, you know I'm involved.
Tell me your feelings about that, because I'm sure you've read a lot, watched a lot. You probably talked to him about it a little bit. If someone had asked you to fly a B-25 off a carrier when it had never been done before, do you think you would have said, yeah, I'll do it?
I have no idea. At that time, everybody was all gung-ho to do anything they could for the military. And I guess I would have, yeah, even though I wasn't qualified.
And we just passed the 80th anniversary of the Doolittle Raid. It's a long time ago. A lot has been said and written. But how do you view it? Give me your description of what they did and why it was significant.
Well, I think actually it caused a change in the whole war from the Japanese standpoint. They had been on the offensive. And that's the thing that made them pull their horns in. They had antlers out in the Pacific everywhere. But once that happened, it went to the homeland, things changed, and they restructured their defense. And I think it was really important, yeah.
Have you ever tried to wrap your brain around the odds involved and what could have happened or what many of them figured would happen?
Never ever thought about it, no. Most of the time you never do. You figure you're going to succeed. And that's what makes you succeed, I think, having that attitude.
Well, yeah, and I'm interested in your view, and maybe if there's anything your brother ever shared with you about it, I'd be interested in hearing that. But I'm just wondering how much courage it takes, A, to sign up for it, B, to do it, knowing you can't come back to the carrier, you don't know where you're going to land or who's going to find you when you do, if you're able to land.
You know, most of the times when you're in a situation like that, you don't think of the outcome. You accomplish what you're set to do, and after that's happened, you're going to make the best of what you can do. I think everybody kind of felt that way, yeah.
And are there some things that, after the fact, your brother shared with you about his experience on that mission?
Oh, yeah. He ended up in China. He was quite impressed with the Chinese and all the help they got. And that impressed me, listening to his tales.
And from what I read, the B-25 that he was on, crew number 11, its engine stopped 10,000 feet over China because they ran out of gas, and they actually had to bail out in the dark of night.
Yeah, I guess he did parachute out, but not all of them did.
And then they found some friendlies on the ground to help guide them to safety?
Chinese did, yeah. They evaded the Japanese for quite a while. Several of them that had been in the Doolittle group, yeah. Although the natives helped them, the Chinese.
And he would go on to fly 53 missions in Europe before the war was over and made it a career in the Air Force, retiring as a lieutenant colonel in the 1960s. But you said when you saw him off and you asked about the B-25s on the carrier, he said, watch the news. So give me those developments from your perspective. How did you find out what had happened and what was that like when you saw what they had done?
It was a shock, yeah, to be that close to what really happened, yeah. And nobody else in the world knew what they did, yeah.
And was there a period of time where your family didn't know if he had survived or not?
Oh, yeah, yeah, quite a while. Being a young guy, that didn't bother me much. I knew he'd get out of it.
Did he know?
I don't think so, no. I think any of them did. They had to take it the way it was. It wasn't any other way.
Do you remember when you finally found out that he was alive, that he'd made it through?
Yeah, that was a real occasion in the house. In fact, in the whole nation, they were celebrating the Doolittle raid, yeah.
All that was happening before you had a chance to fly. Did all of that have any impact on you and your focus or what you wanted to do?
At the time, I didn't know it. Uh-huh. Yeah, sure it did. Yeah.
And you told us, you know, the rivalry between the Army Air Corps, later the Air Force, and you as a naval aviator. So tell me about that journey. What was your first taste of it in the Navy?
Well, I went through pre-flight, which is, what, 3 or 4 months of hell. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with aviation. So I had a lot of time to think. And it's at the time you thought, is this ever going to pay out? Is it worth doing? But in the end, it did, yeah.
Where'd you do that pre-flight?
St. Mary's pre-flight school. Yeah.
I hear they had a pretty good football team back then, the St. Mary's pre-flight team.
Probably did away with it when the war started. I don't think we went into their games when I was at St. Mary's.
I'm just wondering what it felt like for you when you finally got to fly, when you were at the controls and you were up there.
Well, I did it before that in a Cub, doing it on your own, you know, with not a military program. So I had gotten a little feeling of it ahead of time. It was an accomplishment, yeah.
And, you know, I've also talked to a lot of guys over the years who they signed up to be a pilot, but that didn't work out. They washed out or they ended up as navigators or engineers or gunners or whatever. Was there ever a day where you weren't sure you were going to cut the mustard?
Never, no. I don't know what I would have done.
That does seem to be on the checklist. The requirements for being a fighter pilot is confidence. Yeah. So where'd you go from there? When you're done at St. Mary's, what was next?
Oh, that was to get you in physical condition to become an aviator, they said, making you run every morning and just athletics. Yeah, a little bit of classwork, but not much.
Mm-hmm. And what other aircraft did you get to fly along the way?
Started with steerman and the training. And then we stepped right away up to what we called a TV-2. It was a Vultee. We called the Vultee Vibrator, 440 horsepower. And then the AT-6. So not too much in training aircraft, three of them. Melbourne, Florida, Corpus Christi. They had several fields, outlying fields, around Corpus. So you'd go through those, depending on what kind of plane you flew, you'd go through one of those fields just for those airplanes. So for the Hellcat, I was at a small field just outside of Houston.
And, you know, during all that training, did you ever have any hiccups, any close calls, any incidents that concerned you a little bit?
Yeah, I lost my teeth along the way. I had many. None of them I really want to talk about.
We want to know.
We're just trying to put ourselves in your shoes or in your cockpit, so to speak, and understand what it's like.
Most of my downfall, I'm sure, was my own fault, and I hate to sit to talk about it. I was up at Livermore. They had, I was just on a night flight. Nothing was wrong. They briefed you. If you ever have anything wrong, we got behind the seat. They've got flares. You can pull a flare out. And you can see that flare for 50 miles. So I said, where did he say that flare was? And yeah, it was nothing to do. And now, where in the heck was that handle for the reaching around and looking and trying to think that I had might be all ready to pull the handle when I had to. I reached around and pulled it up and, oops, there it is. It went off in the cockpit. Scared the hell out of me.
I think that would happen to a lot of people. Yeah. And it probably was loud and bright.
It was bright. It lit up the whole sky.
So you almost shot yourself down.
Lucky the wings didn't burn up. Oh, yeah. Fabric. The whole plane was fabric.
Well, he made it through that close call in training and plenty more once he got overseas. It is time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old Jack Kappeler of Bakersfield, California. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a short video of Jack explaining how he lost his two front teeth during World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their Wall of Honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. Selma, you can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit, and don't leave without visiting that Wall of Honor.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old Jack Kappeler of Bakersfield, California. He grew up in Alameda, California, which we were just discussing on this program in recent weeks, thanks to a visit to the USS Hornet there. If you're ever in Corpus Christi, Texas, you'll find a different museum ship. It's the carrier USS Lexington, the very ship Jack Kappeler would end up flying off during the latter stages of World War II. If you walk out on that flight deck, maybe you can imagine the time that Jack had to land there without a tail hook on his F-4U Corsair.
Well, that was a pretty common accomplished problem, landing on a carrier. The typical wasn't unusual.
Well, you know, I want to talk to you about that because, you know, taking off on a runway and landing on a runway is challenging enough for some people, and a lot of things can go wrong. This idea of launching off a carrier and then landing on it again. How'd you feel about that?
Well, I'd watched it going on at Alameda for years.
Right.
And I've thought about it and studied it, and I fit right into it. Mm-hmm. I had no problems with it. Landing was harder than takeoff, of course. And then later they came along with a propulsion to get you off the deck.
Yeah.
Without the engine power, yeah.
So you had carrier takeoffs with and without the catapult?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you help us understand the difference, how big a difference that made? What was it like before that, and then give us the after?
Well, when you take off before, when you hit the end of the deck, it's just you drop off and you're in nothingness. And you're waiting for the engine to catch up with you to get you going. And your heart's in your mouth every time you take off. But the catapult, they get you going 100 and some miles an hour. It's like hitting an air brake, but the prop takes over and you stop in the middle of the air. And then the engine takes over and you start flying, which it makes you think, but it's wonderful.
So a little less stressful with the catapult?
Oh, yeah, very much so, yeah.
And as you describe that, I'm thinking of your brother in those B-25s off the Hornet, because I've talked to guys who are on the Hornet for that and also guys who are on the Big E, the Enterprise next door, watching all this. And they say they were taking bets to see if those B-25s were going to clear the water, you know, make it over there. Did you ever ask him about that takeoff?
The guy that worries about is the pilot. He was a navigator. So he's sitting at his table back there and probably didn't even know how bad that takeoff was.
And I'm sure there was a time or two you saw something similar unfold aboard the Lexington.
Oh, sure. A lot of times. You have an engine, something wrong with the engine, and it misses a couple of times. You end up in the water. That was a common occurrence. And it's 50-50 chance you'll get out if you hit the water, whether you get out of the cockpit before the plane goes down deep enough you can't get out of it. It was always a risk.
So there was a ship named the Lexington that was sunk in the Battle of the Coral Sea, and you end up on its namesake that replaced it, right? The second Lexington, the 16. What was it like when you got put aboard that carrier? What can you give us the atmosphere or the camaraderie, the relationship with other guys?
Oh, it was at the Navy. It was pretty good. Everybody fit right in. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know what history the carrier had until you're aboard for a while. And the crew will let you know right away what they had done. But as an air group, you come aboard and you're like a bunch of unwanted. That they take you in and feed you, and that's it. And set you on your way.
And you were flying F-6Fs at first, right?
Yeah.
You don't hear a lot about that plane. There are a lot of planes that get more headlines than the Hellcat.
The Hellcat was more popular than the Corsair.
Uh-huh.
Corsair came in at the end of the war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about the Hellcat. What was it like to fly, and what are some of the things you got to do in Hellcats?
A wonderful airplane, almost flew itself. And other guys would say the same thing, I think. Mm-hmm. Stable, wasn't as fast as a Corsair, had the same engine. But other than that, no, there's the Hellcat was a durable airplane, all metal. Corsair had fabric wings. You take a hit in your wing and you probably lose your airplane. The Hellcat, you get a hit in the metallic part and it takes some of it away, but usually still flyable. Mm-hmm. Pretty durable, like the F-4F.
So you trained in the Hellcat, but by the time you guys shipped out, the squadron had transferred to F-4Us. So you're on the carrier, you're shipping out. The war's still going on. What are you thinking when you're leaving the States and heading overseas, knowing there's a war that you're going into?
I think you get used to that. What would you think? I don't think it bothered any of us. It's the thing you had to do.
You know, because some guys have shared, oh, I thought I was invincible. Other guys said, well, I wasn't sure if I was going to come home. I wasn't sure if I'd see my girl again or my parents again. Did you have any?
You tried not to think that way, I think. I tried not to think that way. Be positive, and you think you're going to come home.
So tell me about it. Where'd you guys leave from, and where'd you go?
Left from Alameda. You go out and join a task force. They put the task force together, and then you go about your business.
So were you flying combat air patrols, or were there specific targets you were supposed to hit, or?
It all differed, depending where you were going, yeah.
So most of us have never done this, right? So we've seen movies and we've read books and we have an idea of maybe a few seconds of action in the air. But for a day as a Navy fighter pilot aboard a carrier, when does that day start? What are the things you do? And maybe walk us through that whole process if you can.
It's with you all the time. And you're always ready to take off when the whistle blows, have your gear on, and get your airplane out there. So you live that way just all the time.
And, you know, just for example, is this something where at whatever time in the morning they call your squadron together, you're in a briefing room and getting some kind of idea of what you're going to strike?
You don't even get that much time most times. sound a horn or whatever it is to get you up and out. And they'll brief you on a mission quickly, and you're gone. It's over with before you know it.
Well, can you slow that down for me a little bit and walk me through the process? Like, what steps do you have to take? What has to happen to get you off the carrier and to where you're going?
Every pilot has a wingman. You go two guys together, mm-hmm. and you're both briefed at the same time. So you should know what's going on. And then that goes all the way down through the group that everybody's on the same page. Every flight's going to be different what your objective is.
Can you give me an example of maybe a mission that you flew?
Oh, it's hard to say. Most of them are very short period of time because we didn't have to fly very far to get to objectives. Mm-hmm. Like I'm in Japan at the end of the war. You're right offshore. They didn't have much of a defense. What little they did have, they were good at. I lost my teeth on one of the...
We were talking about targets, right? So you said you take off. Your wingman is very important. Did you have the same wingman on most of those missions?
Yep.
Who was that?
Art Lindelman, this guy, still alive in Oklahoma.
Really?
Yeah. He lived and ate and drank and went to the John together.
I haven't heard that last one too often. I mean, usually that's a solo sport. And so you two...
In sync.
In sync or in stink? Well, okay. So you two are still in contact?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And can you give us a sense of how close that relationship was? I mean, how well you two knew each other? You just told me the things you did together, but how close were you?
It's as close as my brother and I were ever. Mm. Probably closer because mm-hmm. we bunked together for so long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And once you're up in the air, you need to really rely on each other.
Yep. Every little instinct. You know his and he knows yours. Yeah.
So how would that work? You're off the carrier and you know where you're headed and what the target is.
Right.
What do the two of you do from takeoff to that return landing?
Well, if most of the time you'd be strafing something. Mm-hmm. So you'd stay two planes together, try never to separate. Hit your target, then you'd have a point to gather and organize and go back to the ship. And it just was automatic. You go to your point and rotate it, circulate around until you see the rest of the group and get together and head back.
And what kind of targets were you guys typically hitting?
Well, they varied. Mainly the first in Japan was their industrial plants, hitting those with heavy ordnance, probably 500-pound bombs, and destroying factories and anything that gave them the support. Yeah. I got to go ashore and see some of the things we did.
Really?
Yeah.
And you're talking about strafing. And so you're strafing vehicles, positions, anti-aircraft guns, what?
You wanted, yeah. But when you're strafing, that's a separate mode. You wouldn't be bombing at the same time.
And if you're strafing targets on the ground, sometimes there's stuff coming back up at you, right?
Always.
That sounds a little nerve-wracking to me.
Well, you get used to it.
Mm-hmm. What does that require, like mentally, psychologically, when you're doing that and you know you could be shot down?
A real dumbbell.
Out of sight, out of mind? Out of sight, out of mind?
How'd I ever get here?
Yeah.
Well, and maybe you can share that with me. What were some of the hazards that you had to be prepared for?
Just getting the airplane taken apart and ending out in the water, mm-hmm. miles from anybody else.
So you're dealing with anti-aircraft fire from the ground.
Usually we didn't have that much if you're at sea.
But if you are at sea, ships can be firing at you. Yeah. Enemy planes in the air could be firing at you.
Right. You got to think, I was at the end of the war.
Right.
The Japanese didn't have many planes left.
Mm-hmm.
They were lucky to take care of themselves without being aggressive.
And, you know, you talked about bombing factories and stuff like that. And there are different kinds of bombing runs too, right? You could have a dive bomb, a skip bomb, a glide bomb. What were kind of the different methods you used to try to get those bombs where they were supposed to go?
Yeah, it was always up to your leader when you were going in. But like you say, you might have 10 different things you're trying to hit. So you use a different approach to each one of them. You'd get as close to putting them right on the spot, almost sitting them out individually, as just throwing them out and scatter bombing, yeah.
And I guess that's what I want to understand is, how do you do that? And was there an incident or two that you remember that you say, boy, I did that pretty well that time?
Well, you do it with your wingman. You'd be two of you will do the same thing at the same time. The wingman is firing and dropping. He might not even see what he's dropping it on. Mm-hmm. But so you got two planes doing what one plane is doing. So it's all pretty automatic. You don't see what you're doing or what you accomplish until somebody else tells you later on. You're so fast going by it all.
Yeah.
You can't see anything, yeah. You're not going to stop and look.
And we have heard you talk about the confidence and the assurance required to be a fighter pilot, but your family tells me you've also remarked over the years about being scared or feeling some level of concern on every single mission.
And the older you got, I think the worse it got, because you realize what could happen.
Well, he's still here and headed for birthday number 100 in December, so we know the worst that could have happened didn't happen, but he did come pretty close. If you haven't found that video online yet of Jack telling the story of how he lost his teeth, don't worry. He's going to tell us right here on the radio when we come back. You'll find that short video at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, along with photos of Jack then and now, and some links to more information about his older brother, Frank, one of those 79 courageous Americans who carried out the Doolittle Raid 80 years ago. I also want to thank loyal Hometown Heroes listener Arnold Martinez for introducing me to Jack Kapler and his family. Arnold interviews World War II vets wherever he finds them, and he preserves their memories. And you know, if we all did that with just the veterans in each one of our circles, well, I guess I'm kind of preaching to the choir when it comes to this audience. Hometown Heroes is going to be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 99-year-old Jack Kapler of Bakersfield, California. We've already learned quite a bit today, like how neon lights came to the U.S. It was Jack's father who had that first contract with Electrical Products Corporation, responsible for more familiar signs for you than you probably even realize. Jack's brother Frank was one of the Doolittle Raiders, a navigator who later became a bombardier and made it a career in the Air Force. And wanting to be a little different, Jack decided to do his flying in the Navy, eventually piloting F-6F Hellcat and F-4U Corsair fighters. He mentioned still being in touch with his wingman. And if you've enjoyed the revival of the Top Gun movie franchise with the new film Maverick, or maybe you're just a fan of the original, you might find it interesting, the call sign that Jack's wingman carried.
Yeah, Art Lindelman, Goose Lindelman. He's from Goose Creek, Texas. That was his call, Goose.
So long before this Top Gun movie, decades later, your wingman was Goose.
Oh, did they have a Goose in that?
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't from Goose Creek, though.
No.
Are there some memories you have of where Goose was really important to you or vice versa, where you guys had to be there for each other in a way that was out of the ordinary?
Many times, but I can't recall any one particular one that would be above the others. Sometimes you'd have an emergency where he'd come to stay by your side and you'd go in and make the landing and one plane would make it and then he would have to ditch or something and He was here there to protect you, or make sure you got down. He's the one that had the problem. That happened many times, yeah.
Well, give me a taste of that. What kind of emergencies are we talking about here?
Engines, when you have gunfire going into your plane, you have engines with parts probably trying to fall off. And when they start vibrating and shaking, you know something's wrong.
And you're saying that from firsthand experience?
Yes, ma'am.
So I got to ask you a little more about that here. Tell me what happened. You got shot up and your engine was going out on you?
I've had that a few times, yeah. A lot of times it can happen. You make a strafing run, and you don't even know whether you were hit or not while you're making it. But on your way home, you find out you're losing half your cylinders, and the engine's starting to act up.
So you're trying to get back to your carrier, and all of a sudden, you're sputtering a little bit?
Yeah, and you're with your wingman. The two of you sputter together.
And are you starting to contemplate having to bail out?
Yeah, first thing, you don't bail out if you can help it. You make a water landing.
Ditch in the water and hope someone's there to pick you up.
Stay there with the plane as long as you can, as long as it floats, yeah.
How close do you think you came to having to do that?
Oh, a few times, I guess, but never actually had to do it.
So in a scenario like that, your wingman can fly next to you and try to give you a visual on what you can't see?
Oh, no, he can't. You have a hard time talking the last minutes.
Yeah.
The wingman's just there to make sure he gets down all right, gets out of the cockpit, and stays long enough to guide somebody in to pick you up, yeah.
Well, I know this sounds kind of like a cliche, but it seems like everybody's got an answer to it. You know, whether guys were in the air or on the ground or in the water, seems like everybody remembers a closest call or a moment where it could have been them. Is there a moment for you that you look back on and say, hey, that was my closest call?
Not really, no. I had many, many, and they all seem to be close.
Yeah?
No, there was not one that was worse than the others.
How'd you lose your two front teeth?
If I didn't have my tail hooked, you're going into a barrier at about 130. Pull your shoulder straps down, tighten up, and put your seat as low as it'll go. Protect your head.
You're saying this like this is no big deal, but this is life and death.
It happened. You have to. What do you do?
So you knew your tail hook had broken off?
Well, yeah, you knew that your wingman would tell you what your tail hook looked like, yeah.
So you're radioing in, I have no tail hook, you need to put the net up, the barrier?
They have a barrier, yes, that automatically put it up when they know you're coming in. They do that in a matter of minutes.
But then you still have to do it. I can only imagine what goes through your mind, because you've never done this before.
No, you don't practice it.
Yeah, I don't know what the statistics would be if they did practice that.
You want to keep the plane slow enough, right above stall speed, that you're not going to be tearing the whole airplane apart with you in it.
So I'd really love to know what those few moments were like for you, because you know this is not going to be pretty. It's not going to be normal. It's not going to be safe or easy. What goes through your mind as you're approaching that runway?
So fast you don't have a chance to think about it. It's there and then it's over with.
So I think maybe some of us imagine closing our eyes, clenching our teeth, saying a prayer, doing something.
No, I didn't have a chance to do that.
Yeah.
And what did it feel like?
I can't tell you.
You know, every day for the last, 77 years, you've had what I'm sure is a reminder of this because what it did to your teeth. So what happened to your teeth? What caused that?
When your shoulder straps break, it went right into the dash and it hit me in the mouth and pushed my upper teeth back.
It's like somebody punched you in the mouth.
Yeah, doing 130 miles an hour and then you come to a stop.
Did that knock you unconscious?
Well, probably could you. I didn't know. Probably stuns you, sure.
And you've seen pictures of what your plane looked like after that.
Yeah, so pictures of my face.
What do you think of when you see those photos?
Horrible. Why would a guy do this?
You know, whether it was that rough landing on the carrier that cost you your teeth or other close calls, because you said you had several, have you ever looked back and realized, hey, if that didn't work out that way, there's four kids and six grandkids and now great grandkids who wouldn't be here?
Never thought of that. No, I hadn't got that far in life.
Maybe when you hit 100 in a few months, you'll think that.
It was just me at that time.
Yeah.
Me, me, me.
So I want to talk about this drop in supplies relief for prisoners of war. Yeah. Your brother could have easily become a prisoner of war. Or he probably would have been executed if he was caught by the Japanese at that point. When they told you you were going to be dropping supplies for prisoners of war, did that feel different from your bombing and strafing missions?
Probably felt more important thinking you're helping some of the guys down there. And at that time, whoever knew I was dropping supplies to a college professor that would be one of my professors. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, my paleo professor, Dr. Kleinfeld, was a prisoner of war in the Marianas with his wife. Mm. And he was in a prisoner of war camp there. We flew in and dropped packages, each one of them. And he had the Lexington planes marked. So when I got into school, he asked me if I was there. And I was dropping packages to he and his wife at the time, he figured out.
How about that?
Yeah. Dr. Kleinfeld is a heck of a professor.
So he was probably a POW for a long time.
And his wife with him. They didn't treat the wives very well. A lot of them were out there working. Yeah, he was doing research in paleontology in the Philippines.
And is that something you guys did a lot of, or just once, or how many times did you do that?
I had it a few times, a couple times, I guess.
I want to put all the pieces of that puzzle together. At the time, you're just a Navy flyer, and you probably had a whole squadron of Corsairs that are going over and dropping stuff, right? Would you drop it just like a bomb, or how would you do it?
Yeah, they had a rack, just like a little parachute, not very heavy, 50 pounds maybe, that if it hit them, it wasn't going to kill them.
Well, I've had prisoners of war tell me they saw that. They saw guys killed by supplies dropped.
Yeah, you had to be careful.
I should ask you, too, do you remember what it felt like when you found out Japan had surrendered and this was all over?
Oh, it was a relief, yeah. We were all expecting it. They kept going day after day. The word would get out the war is over, and it wouldn't be. It'd go on for another week or two.
Yeah.
You got used to it.
Was there any celebration aboard your ship when it finally happened?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, everybody rah-rah, and it didn't last too long. I knew it was going to happen. Yeah.
And what were you thinking when the war was over? Did you have an idea of what your future looked like?
Never thought about that. Just get the heck out of here and get home.
What was it like to come home?
Wonderful, yeah. I had a brother who was already home, and family dog, and everything the way it should be.
And then, like so many veterans from World War II, you took advantage of the GI Bill and went to college. And you went to University of California?
Berkeley, yeah, which I had been in before.
And what'd you major in?
Engineering, originally. I switched to geology with the professor who'd been overseas and a paleontologist.
So you're just a student in this class, but your professor has a little story. How did that come about? What was your first clue that there was something unique here?
He kept needling me as, where were you? And where had you been? And it turns out I'd been the same place as he was.
So he had, when he was a prisoner, before he was liberated, supplies were dropped, and it said on there, from the USS Lexington?
I guess, yeah.
So you're in the class,
yeah.
And he tells you, hey, I'm one of those guys that you dropped the supplies to.
Well, he'd be telling us before I told him.
Okay.
He might have asked how many were in the service, and what did you do, and where were you? He'd ask what planes we were on, and the planes are clearly marked, so you know where they're from. And he said, yes, we had the Lex come in and drop supplies to us, and were you on that? And I said, yeah, probably was. His wife went through hell, the prisoner of war in Japan, and he didn't do it. He was out doing paleo in the Marianas, and they were pulled in and stuck in a prison, yeah.
Did he share much about that experience with you guys?
Not much. No. It was murder, terrible. Well, having a wife that she was supposed to be defending and taking care of, the Japanese did whatever they want with her, and that was heck to live with, to know what was going on. Bob Kleinpill.
Sounds like he made a real impression on you.
He did, yep.
And so you got your degree in geology, and then what'd you do?
I went to work for Tidewater right from the beginning.
But you were still flying.
Oh, I flew in the reserve. Yeah.
Why was that something you wanted to do? Was it just for the money, or was it for the kicks?
Both. No, I like to fly, yeah.
And what all did you get to fly in the reserves?
When jets came in, I got the first jets to fly. Reserve got the worst pickings, what was left. The active group got all the new aircraft. And anything they could salvage, we got in the reserve. But I enjoyed every day of it, yeah. A lot of good buddies. And they were all in the same boat I was, from school into the reserve, yeah.
So can you help us understand how big a difference it made going from a propeller-driven Navy fighter to a jet?
Oh, yeah, it was everything you could ever imagine, from 400 miles an hour to 650, yeah.
Did that make it easier on you or tougher?
It's easy in some ways and tougher in others. You had to think faster and get out of your own way. But it was easier, actually. They'd fly themselves.
And so you're flying in the reserves on the weekend, but you're working in the oil industry What exactly did you do, and how did that fit into the big picture?
How'd they use that plane to...
No, in your job with the oil, what did you do for the oil company?
I mapped to look for oil, and I did use the plane in the reserve on the Sundays. I'd go out and map an area, and then I'd go Sunday and check it out in the Navy plane with the area I mapped to see if it was as accurate as what I had seen. So the military helped me then in that way, yeah.
So the oil industry owes the Navy a little.
They do.
Uh-huh. Too bad he didn't have ground-penetrating radar, huh?
I'd be in trouble.
I don't know if this is an easy question to answer or not, because you flew a lot of different aircraft. If you could, tomorrow, get up and hop in the cockpit and fly any plane, what would that plane be?
The last one I flew was the A4, the little jet. That's the nicest one I ever flew, I guess.
So if the Corsair were sitting next to it, you'd say, no, I'd rather have the A4?
Yeah, the Corsair couldn't do anything compared to a jet, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk about the Corsair all that much in terms of its capabilities. What did you appreciate about flying that plane in combat? What were the pros and cons of it?
I flew the Hellcat more than I flew it. Hellcat was a reliable aircraft with the same engine. Corsair fabric on the outside of it, it wasn't metal. If it took a hit, some of the incendiaries, you'd have fire going on. You could lose your whole skin of your airplane, the wings. They're more dangerous to fly the Corsair, but they were fighter. They were more agility to the Corsair than a Hellcat.
More maneuverable.
Yeah, a little faster.
Well, and, you know, four kids, six grandkids, all the great-grandkids. You want to tell me the story of how you met your wife?
Yeah, in high school, I was a president of a men's fraternity. They had a meeting of fraternity and sorority. We had high school sororities and high school fraternities. And as this outgoing president, I had to come in and help administer what was going on. I met my wife that night at the meeting. Never met her before. Her dad owned an ice cream store in town. I went to the ice cream store often, but she worked at the counter sometimes, but never knew her, never met her. And that started it, and we started dating.
I do have just a couple more questions, and I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story. You're going to turn 100 in December. I know this isn't an easy question, but when you think back over all of it, I mean, you've got almost 100 years to look back over. Is there something that you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
Boy, that's hard to say. I'd have to contemplate that. It all fits together. Not any one incident was any more valuable to me than the other, I don't think. My mother was very valuable in my life to keep me going. She always helped and determined and set me straight.
I bet you got a few letters from her while you were overseas.
Yeah, she was a good writer.
And I know you're not looking for attention and you're not patting yourself on the back, but maybe you'll pat your fellow flyers on the back. What can you tell me about the guys you flew with? What made them special?
Close-knit, and some of them I still correspond with. Yeah, we still get together.
Do you think it's important that people today know about World War II and what all you guys did?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Sure. History has its way of returning and doing the same thing again. And if you study it, maybe you won't do the things we did stupidly in World War II. So it serves a lesson, yes.
A lesson we're reminded of each week with a little different perspective each time. What a treat to get Jack Kapeler's perspective today. Don't forget to explore photos and that short video with Jack at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Thanks again to Arnold Martinez for letting us know about Jack and his story, and thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. but it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.